It was early springtime and the strike was on. It drove us miners out of doors, out from the houses that the company owned. We moved into tents up at Old Ludlow.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, our guest is Liz Prado, author of the new book Purgatoire, a novel and stories from Forest Avenue Press. Liz and I last talked on Jonesy 4 years ago for her essay collection Kids in America, A Gen X Reckoning. Her work also includes the collection Volcanoes, Palm Trees and Privilege, Essays on Hawaii, which was a New York Times top summer read and a finalist for the Oregon Book Award, and the story collection Babies on Fire. And Liz was editor for the story anthology The Night and the Rain and the River from Forest Avenue Press. Liz's stories and essays have appeared in dozens of literary journals and magazines and have been chosen as notable works in Best American Essays and Best American Sports Writing. She's editor-at-large for Forest Avenue Press and lives here in Portland. Released just last week, Purgatoire was named this year's Powell's Book Pick for Portland, an honor the legendary bookstore gives to a local new release they think the whole city will enjoy. I think you'll agree. Please join us for our conversation with Liz Prado, which is already in progress. Well, Liz, we're recording this on Easter Sunday, which is a perfect time to talk about your new book and its themes of loss and redemption. I didn't plan it that way, but
I didn't even think of that until you said it. That's perfect.
Now, you were adopted, Liz, conceived when your biological parents were in their early 20s, and you grew up in Denver with your brother, Steve, who was also adopted, though he has different biological parents. Now, when you turned 44, you were the only one still alive out of your adoptive family. That must have been an extremely dark period for you.
It was. I felt so disconnected, so untethered from anything on this earth. And it was unlike any kind of grief I'd ever felt before. Like, it went beyond grief. It was just a very deep depression, a very deep sense of not belonging in this world anymore.
When you've written about that period before, you said in a sense it was a redemption narrative. Though you went through those awful things, you're an optimist and want to find a way out of that sadness and grief. And you've done that through writing?
Yeah, very much. And actually, this book, Purgatoire, was really the redemption narrative for my family, because I saw how so many of the issues of mental illness and, you know, what we come to call codependency really went back several generations to my ancestors. And there were a lot of stories that I felt like could have a different ending to them.
Well, we'll get into that. But I want to mention that, certainly as it relates to Purgatoire, your very first published book was a fiction anthology that you edited called The Night and the Rain and the River. That was published in 2014 by Forest Avenue Press in Portland. And these are all stories from Oregon writers. It was a blind submission process, so you didn't know the names of the authors giving you the stories. And you said that only after selecting the stories did you see a common thread, and I'm quoting from you, this was about a group of people who have a sense of longing inside of them, a sense of loss, whether it's about something tangible or someone tangible that they lost, or even a sense of losing their own identity. The stories were about those people trying to connect back with themselves and back with the world again. And given your own personal history and those of your friends and family, it seems you have an affinity for those kinds of stories.
I apparently do. I don't even mean to. It just comes out.
Yeah, because it was a blind submission. You didn't know. Yeah. It was just these are the stories you selected. And they had that nice common theme for the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's get to the new book, which I think shares many of the same themes of loss, longing, identity, and that desire for connection with yourself and with others. You started writing it in 2021 when you were working on another novel, and you described that novel as, quote, reinterpreting a modern classic with a soundtrack from 1983. Why did you stop work on that novel? I mean, I'd read it. That sounds fascinating.
I stopped work on it because it was dark. A lot of the story revolved around a young teenage girl who was sexually abused by a man that she trusted. And it was just so hard to be with that so much of the time. And, we're in dark times, and I just felt like I can't do that. I can't, because not only I was maybe 80% finished with a really solid first draft, and I remember exactly where I was. I was on a writing retreat. I was sitting in a hotel, and I said, "Oh my God, I am not only going to have to finish this, I'm going to have to revise it several times, and then I'm going to have to send it out. I'm going to have to be talking about this topic for several years." And that wasn't the topic that I wanted to be immersed in for the next several years. I wanted something else, and I just tossed it out at that point, not literally, but the idea, like, nope, need something else.
So Purgatoire is your first published novel because you put that aside. And I don't know if it'll ever come out. Maybe not. Well, you have 80% of a manuscript there.
There are
And
parts of it that are really good that I really like too. So I'm always kind of thinking about what could I do? How can I make this work?
so your first novel, published novel, Purgatoire, officially, and it says calls it a novel in stories on the cover, and you also considered calling it a linked short story collection. Why did you decide on a novel in stories? And I have to say, it reads like a novel to me.
Well, and that's the thing, Ken. I never thought of it as anything close to a novel. I always, when I was writing it, this is linked short stories. And like every single person that read it in my early readers said, "Liz, you wrote a novel. This is a
Yes.
novel. This is a novel." And I think we would have just gone, when I finally got a publisher, we probably would have called it just a novel if it had been maybe completely up to someone other than me. But I just had this sense of someone's going to read that and say, that is not a novel. That's a bunch of linked short stories. And I wanted it to be clear that I knew what this was, or I felt like I knew what this was. And this kind of straddles both sides of it, too. So, and my love is short stories, too. So even if this ended up being a novel, that's not how I came out of the gate with it. And I think I wanted to stay loyal to that somehow.
Well, I thought it read like a novel. And novels, well, Lydia Yuknovich, who is a friend of yours and wrote blurbs, and she actually helped you launch your last book, Kids in America at Powell's, she writes in what she calls fragments. So it's not her novels aren't a novel in fragments or stories, but they all coalesce here, just like they do in Lydia's work. So it might not be the traditional chronological novel where the narrative goes from point A to point B with no digressions, but it works as a complete, comprehensive work.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, and one of the things I thought about was take Jennifer Egan's work, for instance, like A Visit from the Goon Squad or The Candy House. Those are more like, to me, linked stories, but they're all marketed as novels. So I was like, well, I'm not exactly Jennifer Egan, so I don't know what I can get away with.
And
But she
really,
definitely like set, she set a roadmap too for what that can look like.
oh, definitely. And I really think from talking to other writers too that it's almost more of a help to bookstores
I agree.
where to shelve it and maybe reviewers what to call it than it is to the reader
Yeah, I
who,
agree with that.
oh, I'm reading linked short stories, I'm reading a novel. No, you're reading this really wonderful book. Now, the stories in Purgatoire are all about multiple generations of a family that emigrated to Colorado from the Piedmont region in northern Italy in the early 20th century. Based on your adoptive family, you said the impetus for writing the book was not knowing your great-grandmother's story. Her name was Elizabeth, or Lizzie, so your namesake, which you changed to Sabe in the novel. What did you know of her life? I guess very little.
I knew very little about her. I knew that my dad had really loved her and considered her his protector. I knew that she had come over from Italy alone, leaving her sons behind and sent for them later. I knew that she eventually married a man in Aguilar who owned a grocery store, Aguilar, Colorado, who owned a grocery store and then sent for her sons. And I knew that she died when my dad was relatively young. And that is all I knew about her. I don't know why she came over from Italy alone. I didn't even know what town she was from necessarily.
Now, you found divorce records for Elizabeth and her first husband, Tobia, Prato,
yeah.
To be a Prato, so the family name from 1910. But that's the first you learn the name of your great-grandfather, who you write, and I'm quoting, no one knew about or were even allowed to talk about.
I don't think anyone else in my family knows his name. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a big family mystery that must have been very intriguing to you as a writer.
Oh, huge. I mean, that was such a huge impetus for this book, is that question of, well, who was my great-grandfather? And what had he done that was literally unspeakable? What had he done that was so terrible that nobody was allowed to ever speak of it or him ever again? And so, yeah, as a writer, it's like, well, I need to untangle that. Like, what could that have been? And so not only was the question that launched the novel, why did my great-grandmother Elisabetta come over from Italy alone, but who and where was my great-grandfather?
And when you started the book, you were doing family genealogy. I think you were doing that simultaneous to that novel manuscript that you put aside. But you weren't able to find much. There were no pictures, no letters, just a few family stories you were told, and not a whole lot of that. You said that after your mom, dad, and brother died, everything they knew died with them. And you became, in effect, the sole keeper of memory for your family. So you felt that responsibility now rested with you?
A responsibility, but really it was more a curiosity than anything else. I don't have any children, and there's just not that many people in the family that I have a responsibility to hand that down to. I did end up feeling like I had sort of a responsibility to the people in my family who had been written out of our family history once I discovered them. And even the people I knew about in our family history, their accomplishments were written out as well. And that was something I started feeling a responsibility towards, because one of the reasons they were written out of our family history was because they didn't fit into a comfortable narrative. For instance, I had an uncle who was great uncle who was severely mentally ill, and I just never knew he existed until I was doing research. The women in my family, the power and the strength that they had was written out of the family history in the way that it was told to me by my dad and the very little bits and pieces that it was. So I really wanted to bring that back around.
And of course, you had little to go on at that point. This is another quote from you. So it's this big black hole for me, and it was driving me crazy. Then all of a sudden, I just thought, well, I'm a writer. What if I just make it up? What if I just do as much research as I can to get some scaffolding, and then I fill in the stories? So what were the advantages of writing the story of your family going back several generations as fiction and not memoir?
Yeah, it was awesome because I wasn't beholden to the truth, you know, and I could just tell the story I wanted to tell. And every once in a while, I would catch myself because my last two books were nonfiction, so I was beholden to the facts. And so every once in a while, I would catch myself and say, like, oh, God, that's right. In reality, this really happened this way and this way. And God, how do I fix that? And I realized, oh, I don't have to fix it. I can just make it what I want it to be. So that was the biggest thing that was just so fun and freeing after writing two nonfiction collections. Just be like, oh, I get to just have fun. I get to make things up. And, you know, in real life, the way things really happen doesn't always have this melodious flow to it. And I got to give a melodious flow to my entire family history, or at least starting from the early 1900s.
Now, despite the lack of family documents and stories, your dad wrote a memoir, which must have been a tremendous help in getting to know him and the family better. Was the memoir ever published? Did he give you the manuscript to read, or did you find it later, maybe after his death?
I found it after he died. It was never published. He was something he wrote in his mid-60s, and he died when he was 83. And I didn't know anything about it, which is interesting because my dad did write other books that he self-published, and I did know about them. And this was not something I ever knew about. I just found it in a cabinet in the basement. And it was interesting because there was plenty in it that was not factually correct, but that he believed to be correct at the time. Because that's the way memory works. And we only know what we think we know. But even something incredibly simple, like what town in Italy he thought his family came from. In the memoir, he thought they came from outside of Milan, when in reality, they came from outside of Turin. And I found that through documents and documents and documents. So it was interesting to me to just look at that too, where facts and his representation of facts differed.
Boy, that must have been just an incredible find, though, Liz, to get to know so much about your father. And in this memoir, I don't know if he ever had plans to have it self-published or published by a commercial publisher, but boy, what an incredible gift to you in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because there were some things I learned that I wish I hadn't learned.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know.
Some things about my parents' marriage that maybe I wish I hadn't known, but that totally tracked. At the same time, not remotely surprising. So, it's not like there was any big, oh my God, that's going to change my life surprises in that memoir. And yeah, I mean, it was a gift in terms of the way he laid out his sense of that secret. I mean, this memoir on page one, he talks about the secret of his grandfather. So, in his construction of his entire life, that secret was foundational. That was everything about his family, him wondering about who was that person and what had he done.
Oh, which you also wondered, because nobody knew anything about him, your great
Yeah.
grandfather and his grandfather.
Yeah. So to see that on the page and have him have an understanding about how that secret was in the groundwater of our family was super interesting to me as well.
There's a section at the beginning of the book, which I found extremely helpful to keep all the characters straight. It's called La Famiglia, the family in Italian, which lists a set of grandparents, parents, and their kids. So three generations, and that has its base in your own family history. Now, in the reader's guide in the back of the book, you say that while all the family first names are real, you change the last name Prado, your last name, to Perella, to make it more a work of fiction than a memoir. So you felt a little freer.
Well, one of the things that happened is Susie Vitello was one of my early readers, and she just immediately grabbed onto this being Prado and thinking, oh, well, this is autofiction. And so she just had that filter that she put over it as she was reading it. And that was one thing that I didn't want to happen. And not for me, I felt like I was still writing fiction and not really having a problem with that, but I wanted the reader to be able to divorce themselves from that. And I didn't want there to be any level as, oh, is this meta? Is this this? Is this this? And just let the reader have a story.
And I should also mention that a lot of the connections I'm making here, and I hope I don't spoil it for readers, you said you kept to the end matter, back matter of the book, just to make sure that they read it as fiction and not try, oh, okay, this is this person, this is that person, this is her great grandfather, this is her great grandmother. So again, I hope I didn't, but just to discuss it, I
No,
thought
that's
it was
okay.
important.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that's kind of interesting about the book, actually, is that I think there were plenty of places in the book that the reader might, on first read, think were made up that were not, and vice versa.
Oh, yes, exactly. Now, the title Purgatoire refers to a real river, so that's not made up. It runs through the area. Mexican traders, so this goes back to the first half of the 19th century, they called it Rio de las Ánimas Perdidas en Purgatorio, which in English means River of the Souls Lost in Purgatory. And that was named after a massacre that occurred on the banks of the river. And French trappers later came along, they translated Purgatorio as Purgatoire, and that became the official name of the river. I think that was in 1911. So that name, Purgatoire, it's so resonant for a novel, and you certainly play it up.
How could I not? Because not only it's pronounced purgatoire, just so we know, you actually say the R at the end of it. But yeah, so not only do I have that, I have purgatoire, but then the name of the county that it's set in is Las Animas, which means the souls. So how am I not going to have lost souls wandering around, people who are stuck in between realms? And one of the things that if somebody was a big Dante geek, they would notice that there's lots of lines from Dante's Purgatorio in here too.
Well, you name check Dante. There's a quote from him in there.
Oh, that's true. Name check.
No. So talking about that, that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. In the book's very first chapter, Las Animas, or the spirits in English, you give a short history of the region. The area was called Huerfano County, which is Spanish for orphan. It was divided in half with the new county called Las Animas. So very haunting names, orphan, loss of souls. The chapter is first-person point of view from kind of a Greek chorus that appears throughout the novel, made up of lost souls. And they say, quote, "We unwittingly named it for our future selves, for our lost souls wandering among the scrub brush and pinyon, able to witness everything in the earthly realm, but unable to act and rarely able to be heard. How did you come up with these lost souls, giving them their own voice in the book? Was that from the Purgatoire?
No. I mean, originally, I just wanted to have I wanted the place to have its own voice, actually. I was trying to think of how the land, the place itself, could have its own voice. Like, could Las Animas County have its own voice? And then it just became really obvious at that point when I was like saying the word Las Animas has its own voice. I was like, oh, the spirits have their own voice. So I'm going to run with that.
Now, after that chapter, and they appear throughout the book, Las Animas, from their point of view. So after that first chapter, we're introduced to the family in the book through the point of view of Jan Perella, from the third generation of the family. And we're taken to 1975 in this part. Jan visits her husband Pete in a psychiatric ward where he checked in for depression and paranoia. And I think you mentioned that that has its base in your own personal history.
Yeah, that really happened to my dad. When I was a child, the very first beginning of that chapter, my parents sat us down on the edge of the bed and told us that my dad was going someplace where he could rest because he was very tired. And we did visit him in the psychiatric ward of a hospital there.
And you were 8 at the time, just 8 years old. Wow, that must have been very difficult to kind of understand what was going on, especially they were explaining it to you in these very kind of general amorphous terms. Mm-hmm. He needs a rest.
I mean, I literally didn't know what had happened until I was like in my 20s. And I was talking to my mom and I just went, oh, Dad was in a mental hospital that time, wasn't he? It took me that long to figure it out.
Now, in the book, Jan Perella doesn't tell her kids about why their dad is in the psych ward. And that sets up the stories of the older generations as well. Jan says, me, Pete, my folks, his parents and grandparents, all the way back to some village in northern Italy, never told anyone the truth. We just didn't know any better. And in a way, you kind of set out as author here to tell that truth for them through fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, Sabe, who's the fictional counterpart of your great-grandmother, travels from Italy to join her husband, Tobia, who came to America first and settled in Trinidad, Colorado. And I'm talking about the book here. And she describes the journey in detail, crossing the ocean, landing at Ellis Island, as most immigrants did at the time. My family landed there. And then a bunch of trains she took to Trinidad, Colorado, the small town. Did you have any records of your great grandmother that traced the journey, or was all that from your research on Italian immigrants coming to this country at that time?
Yeah, it was all research. I've never been able to find my grandmother's records at Ellis Island, which is really frustrating. And so I don't even know exactly what year she came over. And at some point, I just had to decide, for the sake of the story, this is when she came over. Yeah, but the rest of it was just doing research and looking at other people who came over from that same region at that time. And I could look at the ship manifests and find that out and be like, oh, this is the ship that they came over. And her sons did come over in 1912. And so I was able to kind of chart their journey as a result of that and kind of used a similar journey for her to do that.
I thought it was really a vivid description. I mean, you were there with Sabe as she was crossing the ocean, in steerage, pretty much, sharing a cabin with several other women. And then the train trip and then ending up in Trinidad. That's not an easy destination to get to. Certainly not from New York City and Ellis Island.
It still is not an easy destination. I would visit much more often if it was.
Now, when Sabi arrives in Trinidad, her husband, Tobia, isn't there at the station. You talked about your great-grandfather, who nobody talked about, and apparently left town without any word to her. And that's something you made up for the book, since you didn't really know Tobia's story, the real-life Tobia.
Yeah, I had no idea. And I actually had played with a couple of different ways of writing that, you know, where she left him behind or this, you know, I just didn't know. And I finally decided, okay, this is what happened. And the ultimate what happened, which we're not going to talk about because it's probably a big giveaway if we do, to him, was also something that just kind of came to me, you know, like I just worked through all these different angles of what might have happened. And Okay, so here's the story. I mean, at some point, you just have to commit to a story.
Yeah, and that's near the ending, and I won't give it away, but I talk about it a little later in very general terms,
Okay.
spoiler free.
Good,
So
good, good. That's fair.
now Sabi's story also introduces a theme throughout the novel, the treatment of women
Yes.
by the men in their life. And this is a male-dominated patriarchal society in the US, and certainly coming from old villages in Italy,
Yeah.
and how the women take agency rather than living as victims. And that goes back, Liz, to your own family. You said your grandmother Perina lost her husband when she was 39. She took over his grocery store, that's that Prado's Market, while raising two children. And you want to give the women in the book their due, showing their strength and independence in spite of this male-dominated society, which you did. So there's a real focus on the strength of the women in the book.
Yeah, and because I felt like that was an area where the women in my family really just they got the short end of the stick, definitely. And so much of it is the way that we view domestic labor and, well, just women in general, you know? Like, I mean, my dad said that his mother, Perina, he referred to her as weak and codependent. And I'm like, really, man? She ran a grocery store and raised two kids on her own. She hired people. She trained people to work at the market. She did the books. She did all the finances. But he never gave that any credit whatsoever.
And she raised two kids during a very difficult time.
So difficult. Yeah.
Now, Trinidad itself is still around. It's a mining town.
It is.
And mining, of course, was a very dangerous and poorly paid profession for the men.
Yes.
So that sets the stage in the book for an actual historical event, which I had only heard about, kind of briefly. I didn't really know much about it. It's called the Ludlow Massacre.
Yes.
And it took place in April 1914. And the miners had had enough, so they finally went on strike. It's now called the Colorado Coalfield War. And the National Guard was sent in, as well as private militia who were hired by the mining companies as strike breakers. And they attacked them in a tent colony where the miners and their family were living. They killed 21 people, mostly wives and children. Was that an event you learned about while growing up in Denver, maybe visiting the monument in Ludlow? I mean, most of us, I don't think, learned that in
No.
school in history.
No, I didn't know anything about it until I was doing research for the book. I realized that, of course, mining was a really important part of my family history because that's how we ended up. That's how Italians ended up in southern Colorado, was to work in the mines. And I started reading about the Ludlow Massacre and was just really struck by what a, well, I was about to say what a monumental event it is without trying to be funny because there is a monument now,
Yes, there is
but
now.
but yeah, it really changed things. It changed things a lot. It changed the way mine workers were treated, and it changed the way everybody felt about each other and about their jobs a lot too. It was just a very devastating time for the community.
Oh, yeah, it kind of angered the whole country, that they
Yeah.
found out about this and that these striking miners were treated so poorly, and actually all the deaths of the innocent, the wives and children. It did lead to Congress passing a set of reforms. There were child labor laws that were passed. I think the 8-hour workday came in. And now it's a ghost town.
Not trying. Oh, Ludlow. Yes. Yeah.
Ludlow is. And the tent colony site was named a National Historic Landmark, and there's a monument there, as you mentioned. So really, it was an important part in our country's labor history, not just the fam your family's history and the family in the book, and certainly an event that people should know more about. And another piece of history from the time that was also interesting to me, because I grew up in New York, so I know all about the mafia and all that.
Right.
And my grandparents and their parents were Jewish immigrants coming to New York. And even the Jews, all the poor people were in organized crime at that time. And there are some famous Jewish gangsters, Meyer
Yeah.
Lansky and Bugsy Siegel. So this was called the Mano Nera, which means the Black Hand, and a kind of an Italian organization. They charged protection money from local shopkeepers, which was common in Italian communities at the time, starting in New York at the turn of the 20th century. Now, in your research, you found they also had a presence in these small mining towns in Colorado.
Yeah, it was just crazy. I mean, I started reading that, Even the big mafioso from Chicago, like Al Capone and Joey Bananas, had been hanging out there. And they would go to Aguilar, this tiny town where my dad grew up in Southeast Colorado, and they would go there to cool off. And that was, when the feds were really on their tail and they wanted to hide. They would go into the mountains in these towns. And the thing is, there's not a lot of actual facts to back this up. Like, I'm really looking for, okay, did this really happen or is this just lore? And it seems to be a mix of both, actually. But the reason that the mafia and La Mano Negra and all that organized crime came into Colorado and got really strong in Colorado is because Colorado passed prohibition in 1916, 14 years or 4 years, I'm sorry, before the rest of the country, and made booze illegal. And that was largely due to anti-immigrant sentiment, is what spurred that.
Just like with marijuana, that was considered the same way because there are a lot of Latinos who smoked it, hence the name marijuana. It was almost like a legal way of fighting them, making their life more difficult and making it easier, I guess, to put them in jail.
So that's what and like a lot of KKK people in Colorado were actually involved in the prohibition movement. So that's not a huge coincidence. Anyway, so but what we have learned, of course, since then is that prohibition did not make people stop wanting booze or trying to acquire booze.
It
And so
increased the
organized
demand.
Yeah, the demand's there, and that's what organized crime does. It meets the demand, and they just swooped right in on a lot of different levels, from very small to pretty big, to try and meet that demand.
And you also have a incident in there where one of the characters is boy sent to jail for having I think a little flask of alcohol in his car when he's stopped for a traffic infraction.
And that was something that happened in real life when I was doing research. I found that article about my great uncle Steve.
Oh, that's right. And you looked at crime reports too, huh? Now, given those historical events, the Ludlow Massacre, the Black Hand, along with what you learned about your real life family, how did you decide when to stick to the facts and when to take off with your own imagination as a fiction writer? Is it just the parts you didn't know and you want to fill in the gaps?
It was largely that. I mean, and that's the sad thing. There was that much that I didn't know. It was a lot. So, I kind of looked at it as sometimes the facts that I had created like the border of a puzzle and I filled in the inside of the puzzle. And sometimes I had just a few pieces on the inside and I had to fill out the rest of the puzzle.
That must have been rather than intimidating, it must have been very freeing as a
It
writer.
really was. It really, really was. I mean, I was kind of surprised at how much I enjoyed it. And there were still times I'd be in the middle of doing something. I'd be telling a story. I'd be immersed in the fictive dream and I'd stop and I'd wish, God, why don't I have that one piece of information? Why don't I? And I end up back on the internet and on Ancestry and the Ellis Island Foundation records. And I would just put myself through the same thing again and again of not finding it in that frustration.
And then you figure, well, I'll just make it up.
Right, that's what I'm doing. I'm making it up. I'm making it up. Forget.
I really got to tell your skill as a writer. The reader really doesn't know, what you
Oh, that's
made
great.
up and what you found in the historical record, either on a personal level or the nation's history. Now, besides Las Animas, the Greek chorus of lost souls reporting from their own purgatory, you have another supernatural element. We can call it magical realism. A family cat named Luna, who has way more than nine lives. What were the reasons for introducing the cat and her perspective?
Well, there are two different things that drove the cat perspective. And one of them was is the book had ended up getting a little bit more serious than I had wanted it to be. And I thought that'd be whimsical. And then she ended up being kind of a little more serious than I anticipated as well. But the other thing was there was this period of time that I hadn't covered. And I wanted to tell what had happened in that period of time. And I was having a hard time figuring out whose point of view, what character's point of view to tell it from. And I thought of telling it from an omniscient point of view. But I already had the Las Animas doing the interstitial work between chapters. And so I wanted something else entirely. And it just came to me, I've never written a cat's point of view before, or any animal. That's never been the way I write. I'm usually a realist. I'm just going to try writing a cat's point of view and see how that goes.
Yeah, it's funny because I interviewed Karen Russell last year for her book, The Antidote,
Awesome.
and she also has a few chapters in there from a cat's point of view.
Oh my goodness.
And of
well,
course
that's
she's
intimidating.
known for a certain amount of magical realism in her books. Now in the next chapter after the cat, we hear again from the lost souls, Las Animas. And they're jealous of Luna because there's no cats or dogs in their realm. They say the reason is that animals don't have sin and therefore they don't need to repent, so they don't need to spend time in purgatory. So I'm guessing, Liz, you must have a cat.
I have two cats. Yes.
I have one outside the office door right now because she'd be jumping up and want to take over the mic.
I'm surprised we haven't heard one of mine yet.
But they can be troubled, but they're definitely without sin.
Now, dogs are completely without sin, I would say.
All right.
Cats might be riding the line a little bit more.
Now, talking more about Las Animas, which I found fascinating throughout the book, they can communicate with certain members of the family, including Perina, who's the wife of Sabe's youngest son, Pete. And Perina can even hear the voices of the victims of the Ludlow massacre. And her family calls the voices phantasmi, Italian for ghosts. They try to keep it a secret. They don't want to talk about it. So it's like a bridge between the two worlds of the lost souls and the living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not really sure what made me decide to do that. But, you know, I really did feel like going back to this idea that Perina had all these strengths that hadn't been acknowledged. And I thought, well, what if I give her this secret power? What if I give her this secret strength? And there was just something. I never knew my grandmother, Perina, and because she was dead before I was born. And I felt like there was a way in writing these stories that I was communing with her soul and kind of wanted to get that onto the page in some way, that concept.
Now, one more power she has that we didn't mention yet, we learn later in the book, in addition to hearing the animus, the lost souls, Perina discovers she can free some of them from purgatory.
Yeah.
And she does that. She turns her late husband, Pete, who is not necessarily a good man, into a bird, which frees him from purgatory. And a woman who died in childbirth, she turns her into a sunflower. And the Chorus of Lost Souls describe it in a beautiful passage, Liz. I wonder if you'd read that for us, please.
Perina had been a container for our collective grief and regret and sin, holding it carefully so it didn't shatter, so its sharp edges didn't pierce anyone or anything else. She had believed that was her fate, and so did we. She was the guardian of our lost souls. Until that day in the kitchen, until she discovered she could set us free, she could transform us, and we would go on finding our way without her.
Oh, that's beautiful. Now, the family in the book is religious, Italian Catholics, but their faith is tested by the tragic events in their lives, as anybody's would. Mm-hmm. At one point, Richard, who's the son of Sabe's sister Maria, says, "What if everything is no one's fault? What if things happen for no reason? What if there's nothing we can do to stop any of it? People get sick and they die, and their souls wander the goddamn earth for all eternity, and nothing we do, no prayers, no belief, no ritual will save any of us." Liz, that's something many of us have also wondered, even the very religious, after someone we love dies. And I can't help but think you maybe went through that after, you know, at the age of 44, 45, when you lost your adoptive family.
Yeah, that was a huge thing. Like, how I don't have a strong religious belief. So I don't think I had any strong tie to God or anything like that that was tested in that way. So I guess that was sort of helpful, you know.
You could be more objective.
Yeah, it could be a little more objective about it too. But yeah, I mean, I think anytime we lose somebody really close to us, it does test us because that's somebody who tethered our identity. And for instance, just in December, one of my best friends died, someone I'd been friends with and loved for 43 years. And I can honestly say that it has tested my identity in a way that hasn't been tested since my mom died. And that loss just stays with you and it changes everything. It changes, why am I doing all this? What is the point of all this if we're just going to lose it eventually?
Oh, and that's something that goes through most people's minds.
Yeah.
Religion, I guess, is comforting in some ways because it provides some answers.
Yeah.
That there's an afterlife and
exactly.
we can go there if we lead a good life. or purgatory, you know, if we need to work on a few things. So, but of course,
I think purgatory is more crowded than most people give it credit for.
Right. It's like this huge waiting room, like in a dentist's office with only Highlights magazines to read.
That's great.
Now, Richard himself, besides doubting his religion and God, is a talented musician, a violinist who actually studied in Italy. But the deaths in his family put a strain on his sanity. Mm-hmm. And Liz, again, you have this lyrical description, and it comes from the Lost Souls, who are definitely this poetic Greek chorus in the book. I wonder if you could read us that passage, too. This was among my favorites.
Sure. So I just want to preface this by saying the kind of musician that Richard was, he was a violinist. So he worked with a bow. We could see the threads unspooling in Richard's brain like the horsehairs on a bow frame one by one. First from too much use and winding too tight and shifts in the atmosphere. Expanding and contracting, cracking and splitting from the pressure. Abrupt changes, friction, heat, humidity, loss, grief. The hairs broke in the middle and at the ends they snapped away from the tip and the frog and the eye and the ferrule. Not all 180 of those lovely horsehairs, but enough, not enough, to be unable to glide between notes, to be melodious, for dear Rico to have control.
Oh, what a great metaphor. Perfect for him. Now, it seems that Richard, with that artistic sensibility and delicate nature, is one of the characters you have a special affinity to. And he's based on a real person, your great uncle, Richard. What did you know about him?
Absolutely nothing. I didn't know he existed. I did not know he existed.
Wow. So he made up the whole thing about playing the violin and studying.
No, that's the great part. That's amazing. So the only reason I ever knew he existed, period, was when I was reading through my dad's memoir. He made this very brief mention of his Uncle Richard dying. And I was like, oh my goodness, who is his Uncle Richard? And then just when I was doing all this research, I found census records of that family. And so, okay, there's my Aunt Matilda and there's my Uncle Frank. And then there's, oh, who's this guy? You know, there's Richard. And, you know, there was, you know, it was very, very clear that he was the oldest son in the family. I found tons and tons of things to back that up. And one of the amazing things I found were these archived newspaper articles from 1914 about him being a violin virtuoso. And it was talking about how he had gone to Italy to study Turin for music and given one last performance in Trinidad that got a standing ovation. Otherwise, I would not have known about this.
You even include that in the book, in the reader's guide. You have a picture of that article.
Yeah. And then I also was really lucky to find his consulate papers when he got to Italy that showed the actual address of where he was living in Italy when he was studying violin there. And I also found newspaper articles then of what brought him back 4 years later. Otherwise, I would have zero idea about any of this.
Now, in addition to the chapters narrated in first person point of view from a character in the book, including Luna the cat and the lost souls, the Animus, you insert artifacts like letters and interviews. The interviews are conducted by the Federal Writers Project, which was part of the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, which was created during FDR's New Deal. And the reports are called Folklore Forms. Was this something you found in your research or entirely fictional?
This was something I found in my research. They're in the Library of Congress. I don't even remember how I ran across them now, but I was so excited and fortunate when I did. It was really cool that one of the things that was part of the New Deal is writers were paid to go out and interview people about their everyday lives. And so you have Langston Hughes going into jazz bars, for instance, up in Harlem and interviewing jazz musicians. And you have people just going into small towns, into meatpacking plants in Chicago, into all these different places. And then they also had writers go into different states and produce a state guide for every single state, just telling you this is what the state is about. So it was this really amazing part of the New Deal. Now, the part that I did, which was specifically for the book, I used it to a series of interviews with specifically the families of people who had been placed in prison for nonviolent crimes. That was not a real thing. That part was something I made up. It was not an actual part of the Federal Writers Project.
So it's beautiful blending, melding of the real, the historical, and the fictional in here. And it just worked really well because the interviewer was able to get these stories from the inmate and his family at the time, which fills in a lot of information in the book. Now, there's a character, Norma Scavina, that's Sabe's grandniece, and she has a section that takes place in Trinidad where she lives with her family. This is 1945 now. Mm-hmm. So you're switching around points of views, you know, the multiple voices and also different periods of time. And she has a good friend in school, Walt, who takes her to the school prom, and then he takes her to a party at a hotel in town where there are several gay men. And it's during a time when gay men and women had to keep it secret. You know, it was very dangerous. In fact, today's not that much different in certain sections of the country. Now, there's also several gay characters later in the book. Was this something you found in your own family, or again, just wanted to kind of broach the subject in the
novel? Yeah, it wasn't
novel?
Something I am aware of in my own family, although that seems sort of statistically impossible. You know, seems like there's got to be somebody back there and we just don't know about it. But really, it was just a subject I wanted to broach. You know, it was part of life at that time, and it was something that was definitely hidden in the shadows and really deeply affected the way people were able to exist in the real world. It was a piece of identity, and that was one thing I was looking at through here. And I just thought it would be fun. You know, like I just thought. So the party they went to was actually in Denver at the Brown Palace Hotel.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, which actually exists, right?
It still exists. Yeah, it's still there. It's still a beautiful hotel. And I just thought this was such an interesting part of Norma's coming of age, of breaking out of what it's like to grow up as a teenager in a very small town and in this Italian patriarchal society. And I just really wanted to put on the page what it was like for her to open her eyes and see what else was out there in this world and what that brought out in her heart as well as in her mind.
Yeah, I think you said in an interview, Liz, that she's one of your favorite characters because in real life, she was your dad's cousin, real life Norma. And she died when she was 14. So in a way, you kind of give her a life that she'd never had.
That is what my goal was from the very beginning. As soon as I learned about Norma and decided to write about her, I was not going to write about her dying when she was 14. There was just no way that was going to be on the page. I just wanted to give that girl a life.
And what a good one in the book.
Yeah, I hope so.
Now, Norma has a cousin, Betty Perella. That's Sabe's granddaughter. She's a musician too, but a piano player. Mm-hmm. And she actually plays in a local swing band, the only woman. I think about five or six guys in there, mostly playing horn instruments. And they cover popular tunes at the time. You mentioned Count Basie's 1 o'clock Jump and Benny Goodman's Sing, Sing, Sing. Now, in the reader's guide, you write that when your dad was in college, he fathered a child with a woman and they gave the baby up for adoption. You write she technically wasn't part of the family, but again, you want to give her a voice in the book.
Rita is the woman who my father, or who, you know, his character fathered the child with. And Betty, they meet when they go to see Betty's band play.
Again, kind of like the story of Norma, you're taking someone who you know nothing about and you don't really know what kind of life they had. And you're giving her this life in the book.
Yeah. Well, my dad had described her in the memoir that I found, and it just seemed really sexist and one-sided the way he described her. You know, like she was really fast and easy. And I was like, what were you, Dad? You know? I mean, she was no different than what he was. And she probably was in a really difficult situation too. And so I really wanted to just, again, like open that up and show something that wasn't from the male's point of view and from this very restrictive point of view either. And show like, who was this person and how did this happen? And that was the last thing I added. There were actually a couple of iterations that didn't have that chapter in it. And I added that because I liked that it moved the time period forward a little bit more, but it circled back to the story of my being adopted as well. And it made that full circle of what it means to be a family and that every adoptive family starts with a loss. It starts with someone giving up their baby.
I love the ending of the book, and that's something we're going to kind of skirt around.
Yes.
It's the very last section, and it brings back a character introduced briefly at the start and then seemingly disappears, fate and whereabouts unknown. Again, not sure how much we can say without spoiling it for readers, but I found this so full of hope and even joy. After all the grief and loss in the book, Was that any something you had in mind from the start, or did it just kind of grow organically as you were writing?
A little bit of both. It's really interesting because originally when I started this, I didn't have a plan for it to be an entire long novel. I thought, oh, maybe this will just be a long short story about Sabe, about my great grandmother, Elisabetta. But I didn't want it to just be with her dying. I'm like, oh, and then how does it end? She just dies. I refuse to have a novel that ends on somebody dying. And ironically, this ends at a gravesite. But I really love that you said that it does have a hopeful aspect to it, because that's what I wanted it to be. I wanted it to be, we have our griefs. We all end up at gravesites at one point or another in our lives. And yet there is hope. There is family. There are people who love us. There are people who accept us. There are people who bring our own souls into this world, into being, just like I wrote my family into being. There are people in our lives who bring us into being. And I wanted that to be the ultimate message that people were left with at the end.
And it really, in a way, kind of unifies the book for me.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, you know, Keith Mossman from Pals, who I've never met before, but he read the book and wrote a review of it. And one of the things he said was, as soon as he finished reading it, he went back to the beginning and started it again. So that, you know, which as a writer, you're like, well, that's pretty cool, man, because that guy probably has a lot of books in front of him that he wants to read. But it's what you're talking about. It's that unification. It actually loops back around.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a beginning and an end. It's a circle.
So hopefully this doesn't give anything away and just makes readers a little more interested.
Yes, hopefully.
in finishing the book. Now we mentioned the reader's guide, which you include in the back matter. We mentioned that a few times, and you go into some of your sources for the book. It's an incredible amount of research you did, from digging up crime reports, checking federal census records, visiting graveyards, to even contacting a church in Pittsburgh, Kansas, for details on one of your relatives' death. And I love the story of how you found a photo of Prato's Market in Aguilar, the family market, which is called Perella's Market in the book. And it shows social media isn't all bad. I wonder if you could talk about how you went about doing the research and how you found that amazing photo. I mean, it's like history there.
It is. It's crazy. So my entire life, nowhere in my house was there a picture of the family market that I knew that my dad's grandparents and parents had owned. I knew it existed. I knew they had run a market. I'd never once in my entire life seen a picture of it. I didn't even know what it was called. I didn't know it was called Prado's Market or Grocery and Meat Market. It could have been called something else for all I know. And so just kind of, you know, okay, put that aside, because I wasn't even thinking about it really that much. But so one of the things I was doing for research, I was looking up the town he was raised in, Aguilar, Colorado, and it took me to a Facebook page for Aguilar, Colorado, for people in the town, which like shocked me to begin with that they had that.
It's not a big town, huh?
Right? No, it's not a big town. It has maybe 500 people who live in it or something. And so, you know, I go to that and I join the group, and then I just get on there and I say, you know, my name is Liz Prado and my parents or my grandparents owned a grocery store in town. You know, their name was Prina and Pete Prado. I was just wondering if anybody knows who they are. Well, two different things happened as a result of that. And one of them is this woman piped up and said, I grew up next door to your grandmother and she taught me how to cook and I worked in the store. And like she knew my grandmother really, really well. And so she's been able to tell me tons and tons of stories that I had no access to otherwise. But the other thing that happened is there was somebody there from the local historic society who was on that Facebook page and said, oh, here's a picture of the market. I was like, what's happening here? And it was just this amazing sense of, oh my God, this is my family history. And somebody else has been holding it this entire time. And it was just kind of beautiful, because that's really what history is. We all hold pieces of history, and hopefully we have an opportunity to pass that on to other people at some point and have it create meaning and have it create connection for people.
Now, Liz, I know you've been working with the publisher of Forest Avenue Press, Laura Stanfill, for a while, since she started the press, actually.
Yeah.
And Laura was the one who picked you to edit that early anthology, The Night mm-hmm. and the Rain and the River. Yeah, that was in 2014. What was Laura's role in bringing Purgatoire to print?
Well, I just sent it to her like I sent it out to anybody. And honestly, I have never sent a book to Laura before. I've never, been like, will you consider this for publication? Because none of my books have really ever matched the aesthetic of the press. But it was exactly the time that I was writing the chapter from the cat's point of view that I thought, maybe this is a Forest Avenue book. I wonder. So, I sent her an email and I said, hey, would you be interested in reading this? And I would totally understand if it doesn't work. No hard feelings between us. This is professional. This is business. I mean, as an editor at the press, we've had to turn down our friends plenty of times, people we absolutely love. So I was not confident it would get accepted just because of that. I knew that's not what Laura makes decisions based on. And I really thought there was like at best 50-50 chance of it getting accepted. And then one day I just got a letter from her, an acceptance letter from her. And there was like no like hints that it was coming. No, nothing. I just opened my email and there it is from her. I love this book and I would love to publish it. I just could not believe it.
I should mention there's a subtle reference in the book to Laura's debut novel, Singing Lessons for the Stylish Canary. One character in your novel has a canary who can sing with her, for he's a jolly good fellow. And I'm guessing that was a deliberate homage in a way to
It
Laura.
was. I mean, there are canaries mentioned in the book at different times anyway, because there were miners,
Yeah, the
so that was a
canary in
part
the
of the
coal mine.
lives. Yeah. And I remember, like, I even said to my husband, Michael Keefe, at one point, it's like, oh, do you think it's okay for me to put a canary in here? Or is it like stealing it from Laura? And he said, you mean a canary in your book with coal miners in it? You're worried that that doesn't belong in there. I'm like, right. But I did ask her. I'm like, hey, I just want to make sure that this was before she had accepted it, and I was just writing and I'm just talking to her as a friend. I just wanted to make sure she didn't feel like I was ripping her off in any particular way, and she didn't. So that was sweet.
Well, I think it's a wonderful book, and it's a Forest Avenue book. And as you know, you're the editor, so you're sifting through all these manuscripts during their submission period. And even really good work, you could tell what works for Forest Avenue and what doesn't.
Yes.
And this works on so many different levels.
Oh, thank you.
Not just my opinion, but we can't leave without mentioning that Purgatoire was recently named this year's Powell's Book Pick for Portland,
Yes.
and it's an honor they
A
give
huge honor.
to a local new release. Their booksellers think the whole city will enjoy. This is only the second one. Last year's pick was Tilt by another Portland author, Emma Pattee. That had a lot of success. That was actually published by a bigger commercial publisher. So this honor just means a lot to you and Forest Avenue Press itself as a publisher.
Oh gosh, it's just huge. I mean, yeah, they're saying everybody should read this book. It's their version of Everybody Reads, basically. And like I said, it was Keith Mossman who read the book, someone who I've never met, don't have any association with whatsoever. So it's not like it was relationship based in any way, shape, or form. He read this book, he walked into a meeting, and he said, apparently said, I want to make this book Pal's pick.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you ever go meet him after that?
No, I still haven't met him. It's just crazy. I would love to meet him. I sent him an email at one point thanking him and just because, like no matter what else, this guy read my book. He got something from it. He went back and started again reading it. And I thought, wow, that's what you want, even without the pal's pick part, which is such a huge honor and a really big deal for a small press like us because we do not have a huge publicity budget, like Emma's book did, which is a really, really great book. But yeah, that in and of itself is just something I wanted to acknowledge. So I did send him an email, but I've never actually met him. So I'm hoping I get to meet him sometime and I could just thank him in person.
Well, this episode will air after your Powell's launch, but you'll be launching the book this Tuesday, the 7th, at Powell's, and maybe Keith will be there in the audience.
I am hoping.
Now, one last question, Liz. You've published now a story collection, two essay collections, and of course, the novel Purgatoire. What are you working on next? You're surprising us all the time as readers.
Yeah, right now I'm not working on anything really hardcore. There's a few little things here and there that I'm fiddling with, things that would be novels, but I'm not quite finding my way into them yet. And one of the things I'm actually looking forward to with Purgatoire is getting to spend some time with it, because with all my other books, there was just this next book right away, which is great. I mean, that's exciting when you have that much momentum going on. And you know, with Volcanoes, Palm Trees, and Privilege, a lot of the long tail of that book was shut down by COVID, by the pandemic. And then for Kids in America, I was already kind of getting excited about Purgatoire, you know? And so I'm really excited to just kind of sit with Purgatoire for a while and just share it with the world and talk to people about how they can make stories out of their family history and talk to them about all of the topics in the book. And if that along the point starts to inspire me and I get that creative bug and I can really find my way into one of those other novels, I will be excited to do that. But I also feel like I've put out four books since 2015, and that's pretty good output. And I feel okay internally with not being actively working on the next book right now.
Well, I'm sure your mind's always working there, and
Always.
ideas are coming. And I just want to thank you, Liz, for talking with us today,
Thank you
and
for having
for
me.
the wonderful new book. I know sharing it with the world's going to love it. Certainly, all of Portland.
I
Oh, thanks. Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show and would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Liz Prado, author of the new book, Purgatoire, A Novel and Stories from Forest Avenue Press. Liz will be touring for the book, including appearances here in Portland at Annie Bloom's Books on May 4th, in conversation with Laura Stanfill, and Broadway Books on June 23rd, in conversation with Susie Vitello. You can learn about all of Liz's events and her work online at lizprato, prato.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, April 23rd. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope to see you all again then.